It's Jimbo Times. Hey, what is going on, Los Angeles? It's J.T.Dot, and I hope that you are very well. First of all, I want to thank you for tuning into this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast. It is Thursday, November 16th, 2023. And on this edition of our podcast, yours truly is flying solo for the moment. I initially had a guest scheduled for this Friday. That is for you all to tap in with this Friday, but they had some last-minute plans that they needed to account for, and so we are postponing our podcast and discussion for a different day. All is well that ends well, because ultimately, if you've been keeping up with yours truly over the past couple of days, you'll have seen that it's been a very busy time for me, from one part of the city to the next. In particular, yours truly has been out and about at various demonstrations calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And so during this episode, I want to get into not one, but two different events and rallies that I attended throughout these past couple of days. And I want to do a little bit of analytical work and say a little bit about what turnout has looked like with respect to the Palestinian people's rights in the city of Los Angeles ever since October 7th, and why LA probably looks very different to a number of us who are keeping close watch than cities like DC or New York or even up north in San Francisco, because that's important for us to think about, and because I think we should break it down in order to advance the theory and in order to advance our collective knowledge and, one might even say, wisdom when it comes to these movements or movement making overall. So let's start off with the rally on Tuesday, November 14th, which was put together by Unión del Barrio, as well as the Association of Raza Educators in Los Angeles. So right off the bat, you know that this was coordinated and organized by especially brown folks in Los Angeles, the Latinos or Latines or Latinx community. And to this day, this term continues inspiring division within the community, because some folks still aren't ready for it. Some folks still don't get Latinx or Latine. Some folks really want to be known as Latinos or Latinas or Hispanic. Hispanic being the most interesting choice, because that is a term entirely invented by the U.S. government during the 1970s, particularly during the Nixon administration, when they had to conduct a survey and break it down for folks who were these people who spoke Spanish and who were entering the country all over, but especially in Los Angeles and New York after the 1965 Naturalization Act. So that aside, this rally was organized by two radical groups of educators in Los Angeles who were calling attention not only to California Assemblymember Jimmy Gomez's office, which has an office near the downtown area where the demonstration was held, and who is also the representative for a lot of this central to southeast side, going from K-Town all the way to maybe Huntington Park or so. Somebody correct the record on that for me if and when possible. But they were not only calling Jimmy Gomez's office into accountability and demanding that they join them in this call for an immediate ceasefire, an immediate end to the violence in Gaza, but they were also actually shouting out UTLA, and they were taking UTLA to task over why nearly 40 days into this bombing campaign by the State of Israel, those bombs being paid for by U.S. taxpayer dollars, somehow UTLA still hadn't come out with a statement calling for an end to this, calling for a recognition of the rights of every human being to life and dignity. And so I found it to be an excellent call for these educators to take part in, because what they were saying was that if UTLA as a union is serious about rights for its teachers and rights for its students and what is best for teachers and students and the community overall, then certainly UTLA and any union like it can in fact recognize the plight of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank, because those are other brown people on a slightly different side of the world who are also facing a far worse version of the settler colonial state, or this private movement of capital that completely destroys neighborhoods and takes space from their culture and essentially removes people from their right to land and dignity and even self-determination, we can say. So what these educators were really pointing out was that UTLA is late, and that although this may be the case, UTLA can and should emerge with a statement soon calling for a ceasefire. And we'll get into how that might be facilitated a little more easily over just the next week. But before then, I want to know another highlight of the rally over in downtown Los Angeles, or just outside of downtown LA. And it was when this educator, this public school teacher, a Latina woman, actually went up to the stage with her speakerphone and noted that she was actually being sued. She was actually just in the process of being sued by some organization out there alleging that she has been making certain students feel unsafe, that she is essentially anti-Semitic in her practice, and that she should be fired from her job, and that she should never be allowed into a classroom again. It was a woman who noted that she had been in the classroom for at least 2 decades, and so for these allegations to emerge were quite shocking for her, but they were also quite a firestorm, because she pointed out that she's absolutely confident that in her tenure as a public school teacher over these last few decades, she's done nothing but attempt to empower her students through thoughtful education and a critical analysis of settler colonialism in the United States and anywhere it might be found. Because why shouldn't she be confident about that, actually? The state of California just very recently required that an ethnic studies course be taken by every student in the state of California before their high school graduation. And so to some extent, that is actually a result of educators of color such as herself advocating for the right for students to engage with their own history, to engage not just through the narratives that have been manufactured by a number of private stakeholders, especially large and wealthy and entitled classes, but by people and their communities, including people in the Latinx and African American community, but also people who are marginalized anywhere for their language and for their land and for the resources that they just so happen to have underneath them before the state violently removes them. And so it was captivating to hear her invite folks to show out to her court hearing, which will be taking place in downtown LA just this December, so that they might speak out in support of her right to educate her community, including by holding up a mirror to how other folks, such as the Latino communities in Los Angeles, face very similar conditions to what brown people across the globe face, including in Palestine, but not just there. That said, what is taking place in Gaza and the West Bank is, by most accounts, the harshest form of apartheid or imprisonment, open-air imprisonment, by a long shot. The conditions that these communities are facing in terms of their access to food, in terms of their access to water, in terms of their access to space, in terms of their access to mobility, the right to move about from not just Gaza and the West Bank, but to move about, period. These are conditions that very few communities across the globe know to a similar degree. So what is taking place in Gaza and the West Bank is historic, especially because it's taking place in the 21st century, at a time when we are supposed to be well past the days of fascism and well past the days of genocide, well past the days that place people in harm's way for the benefit of a few, for the benefit of some tribalism. That actually only serves to take attention away from the real profiteers of this global order, this order of capitalism, which continues forcing people to devalue others especially, but also themselves for the sake of profit. Not their own profit, but the company's profit, the corporation's bottom line, and the corporation's way of depleting the world of its resources. So with that said, it was a powerful moment for yours truly to witness, and I certainly hope that folks who are interested in learning more can reach out, because I will gladly get folks information as to how they might support not just this educator, but Unión del Barrio and the Association of Raza Educators overall, since they are doing critical work in analyzing their position within this city and as workers and as people who maintain these complex relations to their identity and which land they're on and what their rights upon that land are. So by all means, reach out, and yours truly will definitely get you that information. You can also watch a live broadcast of the event by yours truly on the Instagram page, and that is on the show notes. Check it out. So now, with that said, I want to talk a little bit about, say, Latino or Latine or Latinx presence at these demonstrations over the past couple of weeks. That is about 40 days into the bombing campaign of Israel on Gaza. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because if you've heard this podcast before, or if you've kept up with JimboTimes.com at all over the past decade, you'll know that yours truly is quite passionate about noting or highlighting or uplifting the fact that nearly half of the city is comprised of Latino or Latinx or Latinette people. And this is important because, of course, the wealth disparity in Los Angeles, the income inequality in Los Angeles, and the housing inequality in Los Angeles, the imprisonment rate or policing rate in Los Angeles, all of these things are very much in conversation with the Latinx demographic. And so when it comes to these rallies and demonstrations for the Palestinian cause, one can certainly be forgiven for asking why there actually aren't more of the city's inhabitants at the demonstrations. So another simpler way of putting this is by asking if Latinos or Latine or Latinx people form nearly half of the city of Los Angeles, then how is it that they don't form half of the city's demonstrations or the people's demonstrations in the city, especially given that they have faced their own unfair share of the burden when it comes to settler colonialism and gentrification and policing and incarceration and a lack of housing or a destruction of affordable housing and so on and so forth. Especially given that cities like Washington, D.C. or New York or even San Francisco and even Chicago, where the teachers union has actually called for a ceasefire, just for the record, are apparently doing far more than what the city of L.A. is doing. So I do want to engage that question, because if I occupy a special position to speak to it, then why shouldn't I? And so first of all, when it comes to comparing the city of Los Angeles to any of the cities aforementioned, as frustrating as it is to recall that the city of Los Angeles is quite unlike most traditional American cities, it is nevertheless important to bring that into relief for a moment. And the reason is important is because remember that LA, since the early 20th century, has been this real estate operation by a few different corporations, a few different syndicates, and so on. And because the way LA was built out during this time of the private vehicle and getting around through the private car, the city is shaped through the private car just as well. And so even 4 years truly, as I made my way from the Virgil Village neighborhood to what Google Maps notes as the City West area, just outside of downtown LA for that educators rally, it was quite a mission as I took one line to the other. And I can tell you actually that on getting to this rally held by Unión del Barrio and the Association of Raza Educators, the vast majority of the people I saw then were younger people, people in their 20s or in their 30s, people who are more amenable or friendlier to public transportation generally. And even with that said, I overheard folks who mentioned they were coming into the rally from as far out as San Diego, no doubt by way of driving. And so actually in LA, in the midst of what is really like the biggest consumptive moment of the year, a lot of the Latino or Latinx or Latina people are smack dab in the middle of traffic somewhere, if not right at work during, say, some of these critical times for a protest. And so for sure, even while the educators rally was organized for 5:30 p.m., when a lot of different folks might get out of work, that time frame and the location of the city means you're going to get a certain kind of turnout. It means that because you're not at Pershing Square or Civic Center and so on and so forth, you're only going to get a handful of folks out there. Remember as well that Los Angeles is built horizontally and not vertically. And so with that said, people have to travel great distances to make their way from one place to the next. But now this is kind of a planner's question, right? Like this response might not be entirely adequate for somebody who's saying, yes, it's difficult for people to get from one point to the next, but what else is going on? Is it that people are actively tuning out? Is there some kind of cognitive dissonance at play? Because certainly the calls for a ceasefire are dominating Facebook and Instagram and Twitter all over the globe right now. So how is it that folks who certainly have access to these sites and to these apps via their phone, how is it that they're still somehow not making their way out there? Is there something else going on? Is there a calculation going on? And though I think it's obvious that yours truly cannot speak for an entire demographic, while I think it's obvious that no person can speak for any one demographic anywhere ever, I think it's still fair to think a little bit about how some folks may be calculating against showing out to something like the calls for a ceasefire because they're not quite there yet in their understanding of the issue. And so why is that, right? Someone should ask, why is that? Why is it that even while we've got all of these resources that people can tap into at any given moment in order to educate themselves about something like the call for a free Palestine, why is it that still somehow that is not taking place? And there's a lot to that. There's a lot to that, especially when people compare what the movement looks like today, or I should say what it doesn't look like today versus what it looked like just a couple of years ago in 2020 when Black Lives Matter led national campaigns against police violence in cities everywhere, and which saw people, including many Latinx people, showing out. Why is it that that's not taking place for the Israel and Palestine conflict? For years truly, an important way to enter that discussion is to think about the material differences between two different moments in time, even though they're just very slightly removed from one another. While it's easy to forget that every season brings about change, that's exactly what one might be doing when they're thinking about turnout, when they're thinking about something like, say, the turnout at one march and rally versus another. And so to be sure, I think it's important to recall that what took place in 2020, as billions of people around the world were forced indoors and were ordered to stay inside and to stay in shelter or stay in place in order to avert a larger health disaster. At that time, our minds and focus could hardly avoid getting away from calls to an end to police violence, given the death of George Floyd and the subsequent manhandling of various protesters across cities all over the U.S. And so people all over the world, young and mature, queer and hetero, everybody that you could think of, Latinx and Muslim, African American and white and Jewish, all these folks came out for the cause, and they took the risk contracting this virus, but they went ahead with it because the crackdown, or this very violent response from the state here in the U.S., it really mandated that. It really made a compelling case for folks to demand an end to this way of structuring our cities and to this way of structuring our city policy unfairly, especially in this country where we are supposed to be afforded basic rights, including rights against unlawful searches and seizures, which Black and Brown folks everywhere can tell you has actually never been the case for them at a significant scale, or even on a case-by-case basis. And so folks at that time, given that they did not have these work commitments, given that they were not required to physically be in one location or the other, they really had a vastly different set of choices in front of them. They really could deliberate in a rather different manner than what is the case just a couple of years later and just a season later. Because when folks came out for George Floyd, it was the summer of 2020, and now we're talking about the fall of 2023, or the autumn season. And things are very different as you go from October to November and the holiday season. This is crunch time for corporations out there. Just earlier today, I was looking at an image calling for a boycott to the red Starbucks cup because it is supposed to be one of the most profitable days, if not the most profitable day for that corporation of the whole year. And why should folks be boycotting Starbucks? Folks should be boycotting Starbucks today because of its incredibly hostile campaign against the unionization of its workforces. And why are folks across the country unionizing against the company? They're unionizing because they can't afford to continue to live under the current wages that the company is forcing upon its workers. And so at that point, it's no longer just on the worker, but it's also on the consumer to make an active decision. And lo and behold, we've got folks calling for an active boycott of the corporation. But that's really just one corporation after all, and it's not just Starbucks that is set to make huge gains or profits over these next few months, but it's companies all across. We can, of course, think of Amazon and how many different packages Amazon is sending out during this time, and how many different families are gearing up for gifts for each other, or for plans to travel, or for other things that people tend to do during the holidays. I have no doubt that it's the biggest spending time of the year, and I would love the metrics to back that up if any of the Los Cuentos listenership can provide that, but there's almost no doubt in my mind that this season tends to be rife with spending and rife with profits for the companies that control the means of production. And there goes the Marxist analysis. We knew it all along. JT the LA Storyteller is a secret Marxist, but that's really not a secret because we haven't even spoken about Marxism at length on this podcast, to be sure. But if you're not Marxist or more critical in your analysis of capitalism, you're probably not a millennial. You're probably not a Zoomer. You need to be more critical of this consumptive culture, because at this point, you know it better than any demographic in the history of time. So by all means, if that label seems to fit, then I've got no trouble accepting it. But with that said, the original question was, why is it that Latinos, and maybe certain Latinos or Latinas or Latina people out there, are making active calculations against showing out for the Palestinian cause? And for years, truly, that question becomes far less enigmatic and far more accessible when we think not just about the built structure of Los Angeles or LA's car-centered culture, its horizontal rather than vertical structure, but when we also think about the family ties and the way that families have a whole lot of buckling down to do over the next couple of months, and the way that the holidays are coming up, and what people really have in mind are what the market has essentially placed in front of them, including this Thanksgiving, followed by the so-called Black Friday holiday, and then, of course, the biggest holiday of them all, the Christmas season. And which is very different from the summertime of 2020, when after months of staying at home, folks were exposed to this issue of race relations in the United States that is constantly over the shoulder of white or non-white communities in this country. That was an issue that may have required far less searching and researching, because at the end of the day, race relations inform almost every aspect of life in the United States anyway. So of course, folks, including Latinx people, had to come out for calls to an end to police violence against African-American bodies. And so it's all to say that there are slight but significant differences between that time and the time we're in today. Now, with that in mind, I want to talk a little bit about this phrase known as settler colonialism and its relevance to the current moment, and why, if you are out there listening and you want to understand something like settler colonialism, JT the LA Storyteller podcast is absolutely a resource for that. If you found the podcast more recently, and the podcast is primarily how you keep up with yours truly, then especially most recently, you might not necessarily be too familiar with, say, JT the LA Storyteller's engagement of settler colonialism and its ongoing gentrification of Los Angeles. But you should know that for nearly a decade, yours truly has absolutely been in conversation with this issue at a rather intimate level, because of the gentrification of the neighborhood, because of the forced displacement of people like myself from public and private space, but especially the latter, actually, because Latino or Latine or Latinx purchasing power is still minimal. It's still peripheral compared to that of white Americans' purchasing power. And so you're going to have a city in which mostly the Latino or Latinx population, as we've discussed, is mostly not in control of vast quantities of private space, including, say, rental units in the neighborhood, because we tend to be workers, because we tend to be folks who are just trying to survive and just trying to get by from one month to the next. So that is to say that settler colonialism is absolutely tied to whether or not you can afford the next month's rent. Because at the end of the day, it is existentially important for people to ask themselves why they are forced to live this way. It is crucial to ask where exactly all of the money for a rental unit or even a mortgage on a house somewhere actually ends up, and what the purpose and what the various levels of that dynamic look like. Because if all of these dollars and if all of these work hours ultimately serve the interest of the corporation, and the corporation is looking to take care not so much of its workers, but of its bottom line, of its profiteering, then by all means, there's no question that we'll continue in this way in which people have to fight for their rights and people have to fight for their right to remain in place as they were once told to by the federal and state governments, despite the wishes of these larger gentrifying corporations. These corporations that have no ancestral or otherwise legitimate ties to land, but that simply have the dollars, that simply have the purchasing power to litigate their way into it, to litigate their way atop it, and to defend it with that litigation and various other resources used by the settler colonial state. And so absolutely, when Palestinian people who have these ancestral ties to the land, who've got these biblical ties to the land alongside their Jewish counterparts, when they are being forced away from this land, by all means, you can be certain that if you're a renter or if you're a mortgage owner who's paying a mortgage every month for some 20 or 30 or 50 years, then you own very little to no land, and therefore you own very little to no rights. Therefore, this is why justice for people atop the land in Gaza and the West Bank and what historically has been Palestine is allowed to be crushed by the Israeli and U.S. states, then how on earth can you trust that your rights locally in Los Angeles or in Mexico City or somewhere out in Dallas are in fact assured? If you don't own the land, and if you don't own the deeds, and if you don't own the rights, you cannot. And so actually making the connection between Palestine and the experiences of indigenous or oppressed people all over the world is not that difficult. It's not that complicated. But it is understandable if workers are out there and they are, but it is understandable if workers are out there that it is difficult for them to seek out this knowledge and to seek out this connection. That doesn't mean it's an excuse not to go about and excavate for this information, but it does mean that if you're in a position to tune into JT the LA Storyteller podcast and to keep up with the calls for justice on the local and the state and the national and the international or global level, then by all means, you have a responsibility to educate the workers alongside you, to educate the family members alongside you, and to persuade them to make their way out to these actions and to these protests, because of course this involves all of us. And I think this is a good segue into one more note that I really want to make for you all, especially for the listeners in LA. It is still Native American Heritage Month in Los Angeles. And not just in Los Angeles, but in the state of California, and if it's taking place across the Southwest and across the United States as a whole, then by all means. But I know that in Los Angeles, it remains to be seen just what we actually do with Native American Heritage Month and what we do with, say, land acknowledgments and what we do with conversations on restitution or reparations when it comes to Native people's rights to land, when it comes to African American people's rights to land, and when it comes to even Latinx people's rights to land in these settler-occupied cities, states, and then some. Because what is taking place today in Gaza, and what took place just earlier this year in the Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh region, is absolutely what we call a genocide. A genocide is an operation with a deliberate intent to inflict harm on a people strictly based on their difference from the people who you recognize as the rightful inhabitants of one state or another. And I challenge any listener out there to note how that differs from what took place to Native Americans across the United States, and especially Native Californians right here in the so-called Golden State. In the Golden State, or California, before the first Spanish missions in the early to late 1770s or the 18th century, it's well documented that we had at least 200,000 Native Californians across the land. But by 1870, 200,000 whittled down to 12,000. And that didn't just happen because of disease or because of tragic bad luck. That happened because of the nation state. That happened because of the missionaries, and it happened because of the missionaries and Spanish colonization, and it happened because of the eventual wresting away of power over the land from the Spanish to the Mexican government, and most of all from when the United States took ownership over the Southwest from the state of Mexico in the mid-1840s to 1850. By all means, this is well documented. These genocides took place, and the world was a vastly different place from what we're looking at today, but it was not altogether different, or it wasn't inherently different in that it took people organizing and calling for justice in order for the state to back away and to respect the right of people and their land. To this day, there is an ongoing conflict, an ongoing tug of war between people and their land versus states and the corporations that fund them. Yes, in most respects, the latter are absolutely in the lead. but in certain other respects, and in the respects that still matter, the people can and must resist. And so if you care about Native American Heritage Month, and if you care about California Natives, I encourage you to head over to JimboTimes.com and read a little bit about Benjamin Madley's American Genocide, which talks specifically about that taking place right here in California. And because once you do, I think you'll be compelled to note that what is taking place in Gaza and what has taken place for Palestinian people since 1948 absolutely mirrors what took place right here in California, and in terms of the destruction of their land, in terms of settlers' rights versus that of indigenous people's rights, and certainly in terms of the various other manifestations of violence upon people who have been otherized by the state and its propaganda. And so with respect to the state and propaganda, before we wrap up this edition of the podcast, we absolutely have to recognize the March in Hollywood just this Wednesday, November 15th, 2023, or just yesterday for yours truly personally, organized by Jewish Voices for Peace, as well as the If Not Now Los Angeles chapter. This, apart from being an astutely organized march and demonstration by these organizations, was also fundamental to changing the discourse, changing the dialogue on what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be a Zionist and what it means to be anti-Semitic in the city of Los Angeles and anywhere that this discussion is relevant, which of course is everywhere. Because what Jewish Voices for Peace and what this march really got out to people was that there is no way that the state of Israel gets to dictate who is Jewish and what is Jewish and what is not. There's no way. Judaism is a belief, it is an ethnicity, it is a complexity that vastly exceeds in time and analysis the state of Israel over the last 70 years. And this is not by my own account. This is by the analysis of scholars and by young people and by mature or older people and by veterans and by abled and disabled people and by folks who have family on both sides of the issue and by folks who have historic ties to the so-called Middle East or Southwest Asian region and beyond. There are untold numbers of people who can tell you all about how the war machine and the states behind it do not get to dictate who is named what, because when we leave that in their hands, you can be next to certain that it is a zero-sum game, that it is all about one group receiving and another group losing, and we as a people, whether we're Jewish or Muslim American or Latinx or African American, it matters not. As a people, we cannot let that happen, certainly not in the United States, but also neither across the world. And so that is exactly what Jewish Voices for Peace called attention to right in Hollywood, in the city of Hollywood, or Tinseltown, or the tourist trap, as one speaker noted. And that matters. That matters. Because if you've come up in this city, which is still so segregated, or if you got to this city just a handful of years ago, and you look at the racial dynamics of Los Angeles and who can speak out and who has the right to free speech and who actually doesn't after all, or how these things have been informed and convoluted by race and the racial order of Los Angeles, then you absolutely feel addressed by Jewish Voices for Peace when they say it is not anti-Semitic to stand up for the rights of Palestinian people. And it is not anti-Semitic to call for the abolition of the violent state of Israel. At the end of the day, even while in our lifetime, these nation states and these way of organizing resources and weapons, even though we've known this way of life through the states, we also have to think beyond the states. That is what mutual aid organizing in Los Angeles and something like the Community Fridge and something like JT the LA Storyteller podcast or Black Lives Matter is all about. That is what led to educators in downtown Los Angeles of Latino or Latina or Latinx descent to call for an end to the genocide for their brothers and sisters in Palestine. That is what another generation should be raised to uphold. At the end of the day, if we want to see an end to wars between Russia and Ukraine, or Armenia and Azerbaijan, or Israel and Palestine, or in Sudan, and so on and so forth. At the end of the day, we want a generation who can occupy a better world than the one we knew, because we should do more with the time that we have and with the information that we have, not the opposite. And so, Jewish Voices for Peace, I got to shout you out one more time for organizing such an excellent march and demonstration. And I also got to say that it was really great to see none other than one of my favorite poets of all time, Saul Williams, at DeLong Pre Park, where the march first began. It was really great, and I saw him there, probably with some family members or so. I did not interfere because the march was really a mixture of emotions for many of us, and it was not just about action, which is to say that it was not just about being fired up and being angry and calling loudly for an immediate ceasefire, but it was also about mourning for nearly 12,000 lives lost in this war on the Palestinian side, and then some. We mourn for every life needlessly lost in these conflicts, which we can and must move past in order to advance as a species, in order to control the resources around us to the best of our overall interest, rather than just the interest of the more powerful or dominant. And so with that in mind, and with the rain pelting all of us in our black jackets and gear, I definitely just let Saul Williams be. I definitely marched with nothing but respect for the principles and the goals of this national and ultimately global movement, for an end to this otherizing of ourselves, for an end to this destruction for our species. We can and must do better. We can and must imagine better. Indeed, if we don't, then we're doomed. But all of these things, all of these actions, and all of these movements, and even these podcasts play a role in that. And if you don't take my word for it, then I invite you to go to the LA Times page ASAP and to see that the LA Times, the Los Angeles Times, right here in LA, is now the first major U.S. paper to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. That's right. The day after the march in Hollywood, and the day after seeing all this action on the streets nationally, the first major paper, the Los Angeles Times, has come out and called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And that matters. That matters because this is how we stand on the right side of history. This is what we tell our grandchildren or any of those who may come after us, where we were and what we said when the call came for us to speak out and stand up. This is what democracy in action looks like. And so I got to thank you once again for tuning in to this edition of JT the LA Storyteller podcast. It has been a true pleasure and privilege catching up with the Los Cuentos listenership one-on-one. I do look forward to getting our next guest onto the show very soon. By all means, you know, I'm working on it. But truly, if you want to continue supporting this work, then like and share this podcast. Certainly be sure to follow this podcast. And if you have the means, if you want to gift yours truly a Patreon subscription this holiday season, by all means, I am more than up for that. I got some stickers for supporters and some other merch. But at the end of the day, when you support work like that of JT the LA Storyteller, you're truly supporting grassroots and independent media in Los Angeles. And I know that when I see that taking place out there, such as with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, whose broadcast of yesterday's demonstration in Hollywood we republished through this pod, I know that it matters. I know that our voices count. I know that it's worth it. Okay, with that said, stay vigilant and stay tuned. It's J.Dot, T.Dot, out with more soon. P.S. Many thanks to the Robinson Space from which I broadcast this podcast episode today. I have to express my greatest gratitude to them for sharing their resources with yours truly. If you are looking for another organization to fund this holiday season, by all means, check out the Robinson Space, which we have a link for in the show notes. Yeah. Mm. It's Jimbo times.